will try to make sense of all the recent market news since last week's election. We'll talk about how to or when to convert an IRA to a Roth IRA, how to protect our smartphones, and how to make the best decisions when making charitable donations during this edition of On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. Plus, as always, financial planner Kevin McKinley will have answers to your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money LLC, and he joins us in our studio in Madison. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Joy.
So it has been a very interesting week. And since our last show, Kevin, we have a new president-elect. Kevin, help us make sense of recent events.
I hadn't heard.
You didn't know about this?
There is a new president-elect?
There is a new president-elect, yes.
Well, then I'm going to have to revisit some of the subjects we were going to discuss today. Yes, on the election results on Tuesday and how the stock market was infected up until the election, every time Hillary seemed to be doing better in the polls, the stock market actually went up and went down when Donald Trump seemed to be pulling ahead. And right before the election, the stock market turned up shortly as it looked like Hillary was going to seal the deal, and then went down right afterwards as soon as the Trump victory became apparent. But then that only lasted for a few hours. It went right back up again, and last week turned out to be the best week for the Dow Jones Industrial Average since 2011. Now, bonds didn't do as well. Bond prices fell. People sold bonds, and therefore interest rates went up.
Well, those fickle markets, what the heck? why do you think the investment markets reacted the way they reacted?
Well, keep in mind, when things are moving from an hour to hour up and down pattern, it really doesn't matter a lot. There might have been a little bit of the post-Brexit duplication again, where people really feared the outcome, and then they kind of thought, well, it's not something that's going to happen for a while, and if it does happen, we don't know how it's going to be bad to be, so maybe we should actually buy back in if we're already in. It may be more about the possibility of increased spending on infrastructure, might be more borrowing and more tax cuts, which could be good for the economy and maybe even the stock market, but it might be bad for bonds and lead to higher interest rates even more so.
Yeah, we did receive a call from our financial advisor. He did it one other time when the markets did a plummet to say, you know, it's okay, it's okay.
That was probably an auto recording, right?
Yeah, just, right, exactly. But so what do investors do now? Where should we go from here?
Well, take a step back and remember that we've now had almost a 7-year upswing in the economy and the stock market and bond prices, and much of that is because of interest rates that have really been artificially lowered by the Federal Reserve. Valuations are generally still very high, and the Federal Reserve are looking to raise interest rates in the near term. And if they do that, that could have a broader effect on the markets than anything that might happen politically or economically.
So what do you have to say to those people who might be worried about the political, the economic, the financial future? Any calming words for us? I know that you sometimes put on a psychotherapist's hat.
Right, or open up the bar. Yeah. One of the two. One of the reasons I took this job is I remember being a kid and having to stay home from school if I was sick and nothing to watch on our 3 channels of TV. And so after the game shows were over, there were just soap operas, and so that was what I was forced to watch.
Dark Shadows.
And Days of Our Lives and all the other ones. And I noticed the ones that had businessmen, and they generally at that time were businessmen, they'd be sitting there looking very important at a desk, and the secretary would buzz in the guest and say, Bill, Mr. Johnson is here. And he'd come in, and he'd say, Bill, can I get you a drink at 11 a.m. on the day? And I thought, how hard can it be to be a businessman if you can have a drink? So that's why I took this job.
You can open up the drawer.
Oh, right, and there's a nice selection of booze. It was perfectly acceptable. No. What you need to do right now is focus on what you know, focus on what you can control, and what you can do. And what we know is there will ostensibly be a new president in January. The majority of the Congress is still the same, and nothing has been announced yet. There are a lot of rumors. There are a lot of propositions as to what might happen legislatively, nominees, etc. But nothing has been announced yet. And even if something does change, it won't be enacted for a while. The effect might be months or years away, and a lot of things can happen in between now and then. So that's what we know. What you can control is only your own spending and your own investing. In terms of where you're at financially, it might be a good time to kind of look at your situation and say, what are we doing in terms of our spending and what are we doing in terms of our investing? And then finally, what you can do to adjust your personal financial situation to fit what you can control. And if you're really having a hard time with this, trying to get away from the election. Stay off the internet for a while and social media. Connect in person with other people. Go out to lunch. Go out for a drink. Go for a walk. And maybe make an agreement not to talk about politics for that. And if you don't like the way things are and the way they're happening, figure out what you can do to make some changes.
And I'd have to, though, fess up, Kevin, my very favorite soap opera of all time was All My Children, and they took that away from me, so change is hard.
But. That is difficult. You've adjusted well for it.
Yes,
what was
I
that
have.
With Erica?
Yeah, it was. With that group. But anyway, Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. You should consult with your financial advisor prior to making any investment decisions. If you have a personal finance question for Kevin, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at onyourmoney@wpr.org, onyourmoney@wpr.org. All right, let's go to the phones. Lee in Madison is with us. Hi, Lee.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I really like Kevin, and I think he's very smart. but anyway, usually the well-to-do people can't afford to donate to charities, and they get a nice exemption. Sometimes they don't have to pay taxes. So a person that makes like $40,000, how can they afford to donate to charities and have a big tax decrease on their taxes? And also, like when I do my taxes, I have a tax exemption, and it's $7,000. When I did have like a donated to charity, it would be only $3,000. So how can I mean, it's not fair for the middle-class people to donate money, and their tax write-off is just minimum.
All right. Thank you, Lee. And I know Kevin will be talking about charitable giving later on in the program, but
right.
Do you have any initial words for Lee on this?
I better, because Lee said I was a really smart person.
Yes.
Thank you, Lee. That was nice of you and excellent false praise. You're right. You do generally have to itemize your deductions, and you do have to have an total itemized deductions that exceed your standard deduction for it to make sense and, to use the charitable deduction. And what I might suggest is that if you're kind of on the cusp of saying, well, I could give some money now, but when I add it up into all my other deductions, it still doesn't beat the standard deduction. And that's not a bad thing. It means that you get a nice big break on your taxes, even if you don't have any other deductions to use. But you could bunch your itemized deductions and your charitable giving in a year so that they may exceed the standard deduction. Give all your charitable giving in 1 year, and then don't give any deductible charitable giving in the following year, and then kind of do a peak and valley thing where your deductions are hopefully high and that would in 1 year, and that would be the year in which you do your charitable giving, and then don't do any the next year and take the standard deduction. You can also do that by, if you have property taxes, you may be able to make 3 property tax payments in 1 year, 3 6-month property tax payments in 1 calendar year, so that your deductions, your itemized deductions will be higher, and then only make 1 6-month property tax payment in the next year. That's another way to get those all together so that your deductions are large enough to actually get the tax break for your giving.
Thanks, Lee, for the call. More later in the program. Here's an email from a listener named Kathy in Minneapolis who says, Kevin, you are such a fabulous community resource. The two of you make a welcoming and approachable team. Thank you very much, Kathy. She listens religiously every week. Here's her question. I have a simple IRA that was part of my compensation from a previous employer. Through a series of events, I have been unemployed since December of 2015, so my taxes ought to be really low this year, which I guess is both good and bad news. Is this the time to convert this to some other type of asset? It is about $16,000, and I am in my mid-50s. Thank you so much for all the actionable and educational information over the years. So what do you say to Kathy?
Great false praise, and she better be a religious listener, because that's the only way she's going to get an answer to this question from us. Yeah, it's a good way to make lemons into lemonade, Kathy. If you take your IRA, your simple IRA, and this is certainly possible to do, and move it to a Roth IRA. And when you do that, the amount that you convert will be taxable as ordinary income to you. But if you don't have any taxable income of any significance, usually under $30,000 or $40,000 in other places, that amount, that $16,000 you have in your simple IRA, probably won't be taxed at all. And once you move it to the Roth IRA, you can pull it out after 59 and a half with no taxes whatsoever, and there are no mandatory distributions at 70 and a half like there are with a lot of pre-tax retirement accounts. And a lot of people don't know this, distributions from Roth IRAs do not make Social Security taxable. When you're retired and you're collecting Social Security, there's a formula that determines if Social Security is taxable. It's a complex formula, but one of the things they don't include, at least right now, is any distributions from that Roth IRA.
So is this a good time for Kathy to convert a simple IRA to a Roth IRA?
Absolutely. The taxes paid now might be a little bit higher, or might be a little bit later when she takes it out. And that's the question she really has to answer. If she's going to be in a very low tax rate right now or a no tax rate, it's a good idea to convert. Or if she's going to be in a lower tax rate in retirement, then it's probably better to wait. But if she has no income, she's not going to have a lot of taxes. And H&R Block has a really nice calculator online that you can go in. You don't have to put in any of your personal data, but you can kind of play around with it, enter in your own figures, and then see what the conversion might do to your taxes. And it's at hnrblock.com, but we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
So what else should would-be IRA converters need to know?
She has to do it to get it into this year's tax year. She has to do it by December 31st, so she should get started on it now. But if she does it, and then she does her taxes before April 15th and finds out that, oh, shoot, once I actually did the real taxes, it turned out to be a bigger tax bill than I wanted, she can actually undo the conversion and kind of pretend like it didn't happen. Also, if she's under 59 and a half, be careful on taxes on the withholding. Sometimes people make these conversions. They don't pay the taxes now out of their own pocket. They instead have it withheld from the converted amount. And if you're under 59 and a half and you pull money out of your IRA to convert it, but then pull some out for withholding for taxes, the taxable distribution counts as something that will get hit with a 10% penalty, and you might have to start paying quarterly estimates as well. So if you use that withdrawal to pay taxes, you might owe taxes plus the penalty on that amount. So pay the extra taxes on your own, not using your IRA amount.
Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. If you have a personal finance question for him, you can email it to onyourmoney@wpr.org. We may use it this hour or on a future On Your Money. That's onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also call us right now at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley, who will answer your personal finance questions this hour at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Let's take another call from AJ in Oshkosh. Hi, AJ.
Good morning.
Morning.
Thank you, Kevin and Joy. Question. How much can I give for a gift, and what's the limit? Is it taxable to me or the recipient? Thank you.
How much do you want to give me, Al? AJ.
It's a surprise, AJ. Yes, it's a very good question, especially at this time of the year. AJ, you can give up to $14,000 per person per year to anyone you would like. And there are no tax ramifications if the gift amount is at that amount or lower. And it's per calendar year per person. And if you happen to be married, your spouse can also give up to $14,000 to that person as well. Anytime you go over that amount, you have to file a gift tax return. And that's Form 709. It's at IRS.gov. And you file it as part of your income taxes when you file in April. Even then, there still will be no tax obligation, but you will use up what's known as your lifetime gift exemption for how much money you can pass to someone tax-free or anyone over your lifetime. That overall amount is about $5.5 million right now. So $14,000 without any issues, and then up to $5.5 million as long as you file a gift tax exemption. Then anything over that gets hit pretty hard with gift taxes, but if you can afford to give that amount of money away, AJ, I'm guessing those gift taxes aren't going to be your biggest issue.
Is it going to be tax deductible for me?
Not if you don't give it to a qualified charity. If you give it to an individual, there's no tax deduction, but if you give it to a qualified charity, it could be tax deductible.
Good luck, AJ. Thanks for the call. Bob in Platteville is with us now. Hello, Bob.
Hello, good morning. I have a, I'm retired and I have a 403B retirement plan, and I'm interested in converting that from the 403B IRA to a Roth. What are the tax implications? Are they different than a standard IRA conversion?
Oh, that's a great question, Bob. No, it's still just taxed as ordinary income, and it's a regular 403B, right? It's not a Roth 403B?
That's correct.
Okay, if it's a regular 403B, if you have, say, $50,000 in there and you convert it all, your taxable income will be increased by $50,000. And so what you might want to do, Bob, is look at your tax situation, go back to that H&R Block calculator we talked about. And a key line for people trying to make this decision about converting it is the 15% federal income tax bracket. And for married couples filing jointly, that's about $100,000 of gross income, and it's about $50,000 for single filers. And anytime you go over that, then you're going to be taxed at 25% at the federal level. And so I'd advise you to usually not convert anything that puts you up in the 25% tax bracket. But if you can do it and stay below the top of the 15% bracket, it could be a good idea.
Because some of these monies are pre-tax and some are after-tax. I don't know if that's the difference or not.
Yeah, that will make a difference. What you want to do is you want to separate those accounts out so that you are only moving the pre-tax dollars into the and converting it and pay taxes on or whatever. And this is a really good point. A lot of people have made after-tax contributions to these accounts. You definitely want to make sure you handle those properly because it's very tricky. And if you are making after-tax contributions to pre-tax accounts like 403Bs and 401Ks right now and IRAs, please stop it right now because it will be a nightmare when you go to take the money out.
Thanks, Bob. David in Beloit is with us now. Hello, David.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I guess I have a question about, you know, having made some poor financial decisions in the past and then incurring some medical expenses. You know, now it's trying to catch up. Is who do I choose to not pay or underpay? You know, obviously I've got a little credit card debt that I'm trying to pay off and I want to make those payments or face a lot of penalties. You know, but when it comes to underpaying people, what's the best decision?
Hi, David. Well, I'm glad you're grabbing the proverbial wool by the proverbial horns here. Good for you. And that's the first step. It's a very difficult endeavor. And a lot of people smarter than us get into this same issue, either through poor decisions or bad luck. But that's the system knows that. The system has mechanisms in place already to handle that. You know, you're not, thank goodness, going to debtor's prison, and so you have to handle it. And that's exactly what you're doing. So this is really good to hear. The first thing I would do is, have you contacted the various people to whom you owe money, like the credit card companies and the medical providers?
I have a payment plan set up with the medical providers.
Great.
It's a little higher of a payment than I'm comfortable making every month.
Sure.
But I haven't reached out to the credit card companies at this point.
Okay. Well, I would contact the credit card companies and I would tell them what your situation is, see what they can do to help you out. You might also want to go to find your own debt counselor. Have you done something like that yet, David?
I've worked and set up a budget with my banking institution.
Okay, good.
That's assisted me pretty well, but at the same point, it's, you know, I feel like I'm still falling behind.
Sure. If you go to NFCC, Nancy Frank Charlie, NFCC.org, that's the National Foundation for Credit Counseling, and you can also call 800-388-2227, 800-388-2227, and they'll set you up with an independent financial counselor who can maybe give you some more advice on how to prioritize this. But you've done a lot of the steps already, and sometimes even when you take these steps, you still don't have enough income coming to pay it off, and then you have to choose, you know, to pick your poison as to which ones you're not going to be able to pay. And again, people have bounced back from credit card defaults and not paying medical judgments. It takes a long time. It will affect your credit. But if you can pay cash for things and get by for a while, eventually it gets off your credit report and you can start fresh again. But I would definitely call that credit counselor that I mentioned, and we'll put a link up to that National Foundation for Credit Counseling website as well up at onyourmoney.com again later on today.
And thank you, David. We wish you well. I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. If you have a personal finance question, you can call in at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. It is time now for Smart Assets. With the year coming to an end and Giving Tuesday right around the corner, you may be thinking about charitable giving. Kevin, what are some of the better tools that we can use to help out one of our favorite charities?
What day of the week is that on?
It is a Tuesday, I believe.
It's a Tuesday, okay.
When you're supposed to give, yeah. And it actually is the Tuesday after Thanksgiving.
Tuesday after Thanksgiving, good. Well, if you want to get started on celebrating Giving Tuesday, you can always give cash, and charities will gladly accept that, and you will get a tax break again if you itemize the deduction. But it might be better off to give appreciated assets like shares of stock or shares in a mutual fund that you hold outside of your retirement account. You still get a tax break on the donation, but then the charity takes the shares and sells them. There are no capital gains taxes, and this is the best thing of all. You don't have to calculate the cost basis then. So if you have 6 shares of some stock sitting in your account that you got from a spinoff or you inherited from a benevolent uncle a long time ago, and you don't know what to do with it, and you're thinking about giving some money, give those shares instead to the charity. It's a little trickier to do it in terms of the bookkeeping and the paperwork, but you can give them, you still get a tax break, and you don't have to worry about figuring out what you actually paid for it. And you can even give those shares and combine them with another tool called the Donor Advised Fund, which can be a very useful tool as well.
So what is a Donor Advised Fund and how does it work?
It's kind of like a mini foundation where you deposit cash or, like I said, assets now. And again, you get a big tax break on it now, but you don't have to turn the money over to a charity right away. The money can stay in the Donor Advised Fund and then you can dole it out kind of as you see fit. You really have to recommend it to the manager of the Donor Advised Fund that they do it, but as long as it's a qualified charity, you should have no problem. And so you don't have to give out a certain dollar amount necessarily next year or the year after for it, but it allows you to get a larger tax break now, and then when you're in a lower tax bracket later, the money is still given to the charity, but if you're in the lower tax bracket, it's not going to be as advantageous for you. And where we see this a lot is where people have a large capital gain. Maybe they sold shares of an asset and they want to give a lot of their giving right now while they're in the higher tax bracket, or when they're working right now and in a higher income tax bracket, and then will be retired soon and they'll be in a lower tax bracket. And as one of our callers said today, she just doesn't make enough to get enough itemized deductions to use that break. And so had she had a donor advised fund earlier in her life, it might have been a better proposition for her.
Mm-hmm. Are there other charitable giving tools we should know about?
Yeah, one of them, which doesn't get enough attention in my opinion, it's a charitable gift annuity. And that's where you donate, again, cash or securities or assets to a charity. You get the tax break, but then they actually pay you back income in return. And it's the rate is higher than what you'd get from other sources like CDs or other income funds. Now, these aren't as safe as CDs, but they do provide a lot of income back. And because the part of the income income as a return of principal, the taxes are much lower on that source of income. So you get a tax break, and then you still get income back on it, and a lot of that income is tax-free because it's a return of principal. And again, that's known as a charitable gift annuity.
What about an IRA? Can we donate from our IRAs?
Right. We pretty much built December's shows up on this topic because every single year it would be renewed for just 1 year and then it would be expiring. And they finally made it permanent. So donors who are over 70 and a half must take a required minimum distribution from their IRA accounts. But you can give some or all or more of that required minimum distribution, up to $100,000 actually, directly to the charity tax-free. And you don't get a tax break on it, but you don't have to itemize. So for people who are in a lower income tax bracket and can't take advantage of the tax break, they can slide some of their RMD over to the charity, and it's tax-free, and it won't be added to their income as well.
Let's take some more calls, 1-800-642-1234, or email your personal finance question to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Mary in Casco is with us now. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I learned so much from this show.
Me too.
My question has to do with how to protect money that I'm going to be using from the sale of a home, a good chunk of it, to put in retirement. I have a very small Roth IRA right now, and I was going to take about $50,000 from the sale of my home. I'm going to be moving to Florida. I'm 61. And my financial guy has recommended an annuity, and he says it pays about 6% if I don't want to touch it until I'm 70, and I'm not going to retire until I'm 70. He said I would have a nice chunk of money put away, and I wouldn't get taxed or anything on that. And I have not heard a lot of good about annuities from people in my age bracket and whatnot. I was wondering if you could just take a minute and explain it, what the downfalls of that might be more than anything. And if you don't have any questions for me, I'll take the answers off the air.
Okay, and if it's okay with you, I'm going to give my answer off the air as well, too.
Mary.
Oh, I have to do...
What do you say, a financial guy, to...
Yeah, other financial guy. Joy, I actually noticed you were actually smiling when she answered that question. You've now, after these 400 shows or whatever we've done together, now you can almost even answer this
question.
All
I know is that, so it is a financial guy that's advising her
it's
to do this.
It's always a financial guy who advises these. And the annuity sounds really good, especially that 6% rate of return. That 6% rate of return is usually not even close to what you will actually get on the money. What happens, Mary, is that if indeed this comes true, as the insurance company is promising you, the amount at which you can turn around and annuitize grows at 6% per year. But your money that you can pull out does not grow at 6%. It's not like if you put in $100,000 this year, next year you can pull out $106,000. What happens is you only get to annuitize the equivalent of $106,000. And if you annuitize it, you've given up control of the money. You get a very small payment every single month for the rest of your life or a certain period of time or for as long as the insurance company can afford to pay you. But you've given up access to that principal. And that's the only way the 6% is in there. And I'd love to believe that the insurance companies have done everything they possibly can to train their people and provide the information in the way so that people understand this. But we get this call all the time where I have this annuity or this guy is telling me about this annuity, and the annuity expenses are extremely high. Part of the reason they're extremely high is because the commissions generally paid to the salespeople on annuities are also extremely high. If you put $50,000 into that annuity, Mary, that salesperson will probably get about 6% of that value in the form of commission right up front, which is $3,000. And the insurance company has to bill your account kind of surreptitiously over the time that you have it to repay the commission that they've paid to that financial guy. And so I would definitely understand the prospectus very well before you put the money into it. And that prospectus is probably 200 pages long. I bet the financial guy selling this to you doesn't even understand everything in the prospectus. And I would be very hesitant about it. It's not the end of the world. It's not the worst investment in the world. But it's probably not nearly as good as you might believe or as you're being promised.
What do you have as options to preserve their equity or their money at my age that might pay anything?
There's it's a very difficult time to do that, and one, a much less expensive way to do that is to balance the investments out between something that has a better chance of growth but more potential risk, like an index fund from Vanguard, and then the other half in something that doesn't have nearly as much reward but doesn't have nearly as much risk, like a CD. And then you'll have access to the money in bad times in the form of the CD, but if things do very well going forward, you'll get some growth of it from the stock part.
And can that be set up like within an IRA where
absolutely.
I avoid getting all that money taxed to death?
Absolutely. But if you take, it won't be taxed very much, especially if you're in a lower income tax bracket. Actually, if you put the money in an annuity and then pull it out, it'll be taxed as ordinary income when you pull it out. And that's actually your highest income tax rate. And so you might be better off just leaving it outside of that. Don't worry as much about the taxes on that as you might have been told that it will be a problem.
Thank you very much, Mary, for the call and for the praise. Bill in Barneveld is with us. Hello, Bill.
Thank you very much for having me on. It's a question I've been hoping to ask for a long time. Kevin, I'm 58 years old. I have one child. She's a daughter in college with a fair bit of financial aid. I have about probably $175,000 in IRAs of various stripes, Roth IRAs, some traditional IRA, SEP IRA. Because of living overseas for a long time, I'm a first-time home buyer, and I'm about to see a realtor to start thinking about purchasing a home. And I understand that parts of, or at least some of my IRA can be used without penalty towards purchase of a first home. Retirement is not on the horizon for me anytime soon, and I'm just wanted to get your feedback of how much of my IRA you recommend I use towards purchase of a house and how much should I leave stocked away for retirement. I'm looking at getting a 15-year fixed mortgage. If I'm not comfortable with a large monthly mortgage payment because my income is somewhat variable. So, yeah, I'd just be grateful for your feedback of how much to use for the IRA for the home purchase and how much to leave in the IRA accounts. Thank
sure.
you.
Yeah, have you spoke with a lender yet, Bill?
Not yet.
Okay. I definitely.
My credit rating is quite high. It's
good.
Quite good. So.
Well, the lender will determine how much you need to put down to get the home of your dreams. And generally, you should probably not purchase a home that's going to cost more than, say, three times of your annual gross income. So if you make $50,000 a year, you probably want to keep the house in the range of $150,000. I would tell you that I'd put down as little as the lender would have you put down. You sound like you're a good saver and very conscientious and very mature. And so you want to put down as little as possible so that you can have as much on hand in case an emergency should come up, especially as you mentioned, your income's a little volatile and you want to have money there so that if you have a bad month, you can still make the mortgage payment. And as both the longtime listeners of this show know, I would prefer that you actually get a 30-year mortgage rather than the 15-year fix because, as you mentioned, well, you want to keep that payment as low as possible. The payment will be lower with the 30-year mortgage, but you can generally pay that mortgage off whenever you want with no penalty whatsoever. So if you get really flush, you can put that money and channel it over to the mortgage. But again, if you run into a financial rough spot, you'll have a lower payment already, and you can actually afford more house because one of the metrics that lenders use to decide what mortgage they'll give you is how much of your monthly income that payment will take up. And if you get a longer mortgage, you'll have a lower payment, therefore you can afford more house. Now, in terms of getting the down payment together for it, it depends on your tax situation. You can use up to $10,000 of your IRA without a penalty before 59 and a half to make a down payment if you qualify as a first-time home buyer, and it sounds like you do. But when you take that $10,000 out, it will still be taxable to you as ordinary income. What I'd rather have you do, Bill, is if you can, use your Roth IRA because you can pull the contributions to your Roth IRA out at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. And so if you know what your contributions were to that Roth IRA, pull those out and use those instead because there'll be no taxes or penalties on it at all. And then finally, in terms of how much you should put down, 20% is usually the magic number. So again, if you buy a $150,000 house, try to come up with about $30,000. That way you won't have to pay private mortgage insurance. Your mortgage payment in that case will probably be in the $700 to $750 range if you get the 30-year mortgage. But again, go to a lender, go to a couple lenders, see what they tell you. If your credit score is good, you have some assets, they'll be very glad to see you.
Okay, can I just ask, so it sounds like you're saying 30-year mortgage actually gives me more flexibility because I can pay it off slowly or quickly.
Absolutely. That's right. And what you'll find is if you take a 30-year mortgage rate out and you make the payment that the 15-year mortgage would have required, Bill, you will still pay that mortgage off in probably about 15 and a half years, maybe 16 years at the most. But in the meantime, you're exactly right. You get more flexibility to make the payments at a little lower rate when you need to, but then you can always pay it off early if you want.
Thank you, Bill. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC. We're going to continue our series on cybersecurity after this break, and Kevin will answer more of your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, along with financial planner Kevin McKinley. Our series of segments on cybersecurity continues now with ways you can protect your smartphone. I have to protect my smartphone, too.
Do you even know where it is right now?
No. I don't. I do. It's on my desk. Where do we start with this?
Well, let's start with locking it up. According to the TransUnion Cybersecurity Survey, 45% of smartphone owners do not even use a password on their phone. So you definitely need to have a password on there. If it's a numerical one, don't use 1111 or 1234. Those are easily guessed. Don't use figures that can be found, like your birth date or your social security number. Instead, make it as random as you possibly can, or use one of those password managers that we referred to last week, like Dashlane or LastPass, to give you a really good password that guarantees that nobody but you can get into your phone.
So what else should we protect on our smartphones?
Well, keep in mind that smartphone is really a personal computer, and anytime you have a personal computer, you have viruses out there that are a threat to the operation of your phone and to the information contained within, and you can get those by opening a bad email, clicking on a bad site, and worse yet, downloading an application that is completely, that might be a free or reduced price application. Seems like a good deal, but what they really want to do is get into your phone and get at the data there. So definitely turn on the auto updating of the operating system, because a lot of times when Apple figures out that there's a security hole in their operating system, they hopefully create an update for it, but you have to download it or have the auto updating on it for it actually to get onto your phone. And then if you're very concerned about this, especially if you have a non-iPhone, like you have an Android, you might want to download an antivirus app and software, and Avast is one of the highest rated ones, AVAST, but there are a couple other ones out there that are pretty good as well.
So what happens if your phone is lost or stolen?
Well, hopefully you are one of the 55% of smartphone users who already has a password, because if not, that thief can get into your system right away and change a lot of the things within the phone so that they can start using it and you can't even find it or get it back. And you also want to have everything set up with a Google, if it's an Android, or an iCloud, if it's an iPhone, and your Microsoft accounts, if you're one of the few people who has a Microsoft cell phone. But if you have everything set on there, you can track the phone. They have, each one of those systems has an application that allows you to track where the phone might be or where it's going if somebody else picked it up. It does, however, require that the battery is working to broadcast the location of the phone. There's a little thing called a Tile product that you can buy that you can attach to your phone, and then that will, even if the battery of the phone is dead, this will actually broadcast the location as well, and you can help find it that way. You might want to put a little bit of lost to found info on your phone, maybe on a sticker, so that if a good Samaritan finds it, they can get in touch with you to say, hey, I found your phone, and I'm contacting you via email for it. But if someone does contact you and says, I have your phone, don't have them come to your house, don't go to their house, pick a police station to go meet in front of, that's the safest place to make that kind of exchange.
So if my phone is gone forever, does that mean the data I've saved on my phone is gone forever?
And all of your tweets, all of your videos, your photos, your contacts, your Facebook, everything like that is gone as well. Yeah, that's why you need to back it up through those services, hopefully, that you've done with already, like Google and iCloud and the Microsoft account. And that only not allows you to track it, but it also allows you to, first of all, wipe the information off the phone if someone else gets it, and then to put the new data on that you've backed up onto the new phone that you're hopefully getting to replace your old one.
I'm Joy Cardine with financial planner Kevin McKinley, and we still have time for you if you have a personal finance question for Kevin. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can even post a question on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page if you'd like. Jill in Winnebago, Illinois is with us. Hi, Jill.
Hi there. Thank you very much. I have a situation. I have a property that I'm going to be selling middle of next year. I'm retiring. Thank you.
Congratulations, Jill.
I have a couple very interested in purchasing it. We're looking to have it appraised so that we can agree that they can afford the property. But my concern is if I have it appraised now, especially with the new political environment, if I have it appraised now, I might be losing out by having it appraised so prematurely. Is there any way around this?
I think your concerns about losing out for any reason. I'm sorry, you said January is when you're thinking about making the transaction?
No. June.
Oh, June. Even then, I think that the appraisals really don't move that much in a short period of time. Appraisals generally are predicated upon what other homes in the area are selling for, similar to that particular home. And when appraisers go through, one of their first things is to find similar-sized homes with similar age in the same kind of area, and that's what they look at. And so, things can change in the political situation, but at least if you get the appraisal now, it gives an idea of a starting point for negotiations with these people. I take it they're people you know?
Yes, they are.
Okay. Yeah, it gives you an idea of what the house is actually worth, and it gives you a thought as to what if it comes in at a level where it's above what they can afford or are willing to pay, it gives you a thought then to say how much do you want to discount it out to sell it to these particular people versus just putting it on the open market in May. And a lot of times, housing prices can go up, especially in the springtime, and so you might find that you might get a better appraisal in the future if and when they go to buy it. I assume they're not cash buyers, right?
Correct.
Okay, they're going to have to get an actual real appraisal anyway. So I think it's worth it to pay a few $100 to an appraiser right now so you know what you're getting into, and they do as well. And then, obviously, if they're going to get a loan, they are also going to have to get an appraisal for it, an actual one, in the springtime or as well to get the financing for it. So, no, I'd much rather have you do it. I don't think you're going to be hurt or helped dramatically by doing it now versus later.
Well, they have someone who is willing to do a phone. And I don't know how this is possible. I have a farm with many buildings, et cetera, on it. And they have somebody who's willing to do it over the phone at this point for nothing. I'm thinking it's worth spending the money and have someone come out.
I think you're wise, Joe. How do they do that? Do they hold the phone up to the property?
Exactly.
Listen to it, right? Can you hear the cows mooing? Yeah, that's worth something. You're very smart. People don't like paying appraisers, but I think it's one of the best investments that home sellers can make and home buyers can make, because then they get an actual idea of what the lender will be told if and when those people go to apply for a mortgage. So no, pay the $500 or whatever, get the appraisal done, and even if you don't sell it to these people, Jill, this is still something that you'll have in hand for other potential buyers to say, here's why we priced it here, because we went and got an appraisal, and the appraisal said it was worth $250,000. That's what you'll get when you go to the bank to try to find it out what it's worth as well.
Again, congratulations, Jill, on the retirement, and hope it all works out the way you want it to. Jan in Greene County is with us now. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I have a quick question about an annuity. I have an annuity that came to me after my husband died. It's now worth $90,000. It's been paying 4% year over year. I haven't cashed it in because I have to take my RMD now, and I don't really need the money. So I'm wondering, I'm 72, if I should cash this in and start taking payments because I don't want to die. Well, I don't want to die with the money sitting there. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Well, I'm sorry. You say it's actually paying 4%. Is that like a fixed rate from the insurance company?
Yes.
Yeah, that's actually a very good rate. And do you have other accounts from which to? This was must have been a retirement account that he had before he passed away, right?
Yeah, it was. It was a variable annuity. It can never pay less than 4%.
Right. No.
So I have other, I really don't need the money.
Right. But because it's a retirement account, you're saying you have to start taking the required minimum distribution?
No, I don't. That's why it's so nice. I can just leave it. It's a non-qualified account. I can just leave it sit there.
Oh, great. Then no, I absolutely wouldn't. I wouldn't do anything with it whatsoever. That 4% is a fixed interest rate that is available on older and life insurance contracts and annuities. And while it's not as safe as the life insurance and annuity companies will tell you it is, it's still very safe relative to other kinds of investments. And it pays much more than something that's safer, like a CD would pay. So no, I would not take that money out at all. I'd leave it in there as long as you can stand to leave it in there.
Well, my second thing was I was going to, if I never cash in, I have two daughters, I was going to leave it to them.
Absolutely.
And a quick thing about your comment about insurance salesmen on annuities.
Mm-hmm.
I have a 401k with Wisconsin Deferred Compensation, and an insurance salesman tried to convince me to convert that to an annuity.
Right.
Simply because I would not have to worry about taking my required minimum distribution.
Yeah, that's that's not true at all.
But I can't remember that.
Right.
So now I know why he was so nice to me, if he was going to get 6% of it.
Exactly. And that's their job. That's what they're doing. But it's just it's too bad. And we'll see what happens to some of these rules coming ahead. But under the new Department of Labor regulations, a lot of this annuity pumping was going to go by the wayside. We'll see if that still happens to be the case. And again, they're not always terrible, but you need to know all the ins and outs and costs of them before you decide to make the decision. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Thank you, Jan. Peggy in Rhinelander is with us now. Hello, Peggy.
Hello, good morning. I have a question about, I have some credit card debt because I recently had some expenses that I had to pay off. And I have some money in savings, but I'm just wondering, is it better to take the money out of savings versus paying off the credit card? I don't have a huge credit card debt, and I am on a fixed income. I'm a senior citizen, and I'm just wondering what I should do with it, pay the credit card versus take it out of my savings account.
What is the interest rate on the account, on the credit card, Peggy?
I think it's I don't know what the interest rate is on the credit card, probably really high.
Okay. And do you have other money besides this? You said it was $2,000?
In debt?
No, do you have $2,000 or at least $2,000 in savings? So in other words, if you take $2,000 out and then pay this credit card off, are you going to be broke or do you still have a little money left aside?
I would have some money left, yes.
Okay. Well, you're right. If you don't use credit cards very much, you might be surprised at how low the interest rate is because you might have a good credit card. But if it's above 10%, especially, then definitely you should pay it off because you're not going to earn that on anything that's safe, and especially on something that's as conservative and liquid as a money market account. So, no, I would definitely pay that off as long as you're still going to have a few $1,000 left over for emergencies or rainy day funds. And as long as they don't close the account on you or you don't close the account, you can always put it back again on the credit card or maybe get a cash advance if that emergency comes up. So, yes, definitely pay that off.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
All right. Thanks very much.
She understands
Peggy.
I'm not going to pay that off, right?
Yeah, she does.
She still has to do it.
Yeah.
Okay, good. She sounds so grateful that I wanted to make sure we were clear.
Well, let's see. I think this is a good time for the website of the week.
Yeah, this is a good thing if you're kind of freaked out right now. Go to Buddhify.com. That's Buddhify, Buddhify.com. And it is one of the most popular meditation applications on the market. Very highly rated, $4.99. Wherever you are, you can get it on your iPhone or your iPad, Buddhify.com. They call it the most convenient, best value, and most beautiful meditation app available today. And we'll have that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on this afternoon. So just hang on until then.
I love that. I'm going there. So four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He is with us just about every Tuesday morning at this time, and this show is rebroadcast Saturdays at noon. I think, Kevin, you're going to be here next week, but I'm off the week after that.
And then I'm off next week, but I'll be back for most of December after that.
Okay. Sorry, I got that mixed up. So anyway, we will hear from Kevin in a couple of weeks. Thank you to Bill Martins, Chris Molina, Nyasia Ellison, and Brianne Shasso for producing this program. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.